Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The current issue of The Atlantic, actually it's the May issue, has this story. Is Facebook making us lonely? Social media, from Facebook to Twitter, have made us more densely networked than ever. Yet for all this connectivity, new research suggests that we have never been lonelier or more narcissistic, and that this loneliness is making us mentally and physically ill. A report on what the epidemic of loneliness is doing to our souls and our society. Bear with me as I read just the first part of this story, because it really sets a dramatic scene and asks, I think, just by telling it some profound questions about what happened here, what went wrong. Stephen Marsh, by the way, is the author of the piece. Yvette Vickers, a former Playboy playmate and B-movie star best known for her role in Attack of the 50-Foot Woman, would have been 83 last August, but nobody knows exactly how old she was when she died. According to the L.A. coroner's report, she lay dead for the better part of a year before a neighbor and fellow actress, a woman named Susan Savage, noticed cobwebs and yellowing letters in her mailbox, reached through a broken window to unlock the door, and pushed her way through the piles of junk mail and mounds of clothing that barricaded the house. Upstairs, she found Vickers' body mummified near a heater that was running. Her computer was on, too, its glow permeating the empty space. The LA Times subsequently wrote a story about this. It went viral. Her lonesome death was the subject of 16,057 Facebook posts and a number of tweets. She received much more attention in death than she did in the final years of her life. Our phone number, as we ask this question, is Facebook making us lonely? 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. And the email is talk@wpr.org. And if this isn't too weird, the Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. And you can also post your comments there. But the good part about it is that we may read some of that, which will make it more of a community, and you can respond to each other, which will make it even more of a community. So here we go. Stephen, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
Pleasure.
That story, just, you can't get that image out of your mind, can you? It just stays with you and stays with you. Ooh.
Yeah, and, you know, her space heater was still on when they found her, and her computer was still on. So, I mean, even the electricity, the power had not stopped flowing into her house. Mm. She was, when she had been dead for, they don't really know how long.
And why did so many people respond to that story on Facebook? What did that say?
Well, I think, you know, I think loneliness is this major crisis. I mean, obviously, that's what I argue in the piece. But I think people are really feeling this pretty profoundly, and it's starting to come to a point where it's not just sort of, you know, moaning about how alienating the world is, but we're actually starting to feel it in our bodies, and we're starting to feel it in our, you know, we're starting to see the effects of it more clearly now.
So you asked the question in the piece, is Facebook part of the separating or part of the congregating? Is it a huddling together for warmth or a shuffling away in pain? How do you answer that?
Well, I mean, I think the answer is it's complicated. I mean, it's probably the least satisfying answer you can get, but it's actually the true one. I mean, it really depends how you use Facebook and what you do with it. I mean, if you go on and use Facebook to connect with friends and to set up face-to-face meetings, and you use it to make actual comments, like writing things to people, it decreases loneliness. But if you're just what the researcher, what Moira Burke calls broadcasting and passively receiving, if you're just sort of like, hey, look what I did today, and then also, you know, scouring for, you know, the history of your ex-boyfriends and ex-girlfriends, which is how I use Facebook.
I've done it too. Right?
You know, that shows a marginal increase in loneliness and also in depression.
Hmm. So people who are lonely use Facebook, or people become lonely because they use Facebook?
Well, it's pretty clear from the research that there's a correlation, but it's related to, you know, lonely people are lonely on Facebook, and unlonely, and people who are very socially are less lonely on Facebook. You know, Facebook is really just sort of a transfer of social networks. It doesn't really create them, and it doesn't really destroy them. But on the other hand, you know, Facebook does correlate very intensely to narcissism.
How so?
It is a narcissistic activity. The more time you spend on Facebook, the more narcissistic you are. There's just a very, very strong correlation between the two.
Because you're boasting about, you know, how wonderful you are, how great your family is, the great meal you made, your book,
this constant game we're playing about how wonderful we are and how wonderful everything in our lives are, which is, sad. And we sort of know it's sad. And also, you know, the time we spend looking at other people's reflections of their little happiness lives, you know, their little massive social bounty, comparing ourselves against that. I mean, I just find it, well, I mean, the research shows that it's disheartening.
Mm-hmm. The thing that gets me about Facebook and all of social media is to notice the profound change in the way that young people are when they're with each other. If they're having a friend over, they're sitting on their computers. They're hardly even talking to each other. They're looking at other people's posts on Facebook instead of having a conversation.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, I don't have I have kids, but they're too small to do that. I don't know. There is Sherry Turkle, you know, has a lot in her book, Alone Together, sort of makes the same point. I don't think it's just the kids. I mean, it's easy to say it's just the kids, but, you know, I mean, Turkle describes going to a funeral and seeing people texting at it.
Oh, my gosh.
Right? I mean, I don't think that's that uncommon. I think there's this whole, I mean, it certainly isn't just social media. It's sort of all of these endless devices of accessibility that are very distracting from, you know, IRL. In real life, as the kids call it.
But, Stephen, didn't people say the same thing about radio when it came out? Certainly they said it about television.
Well, and it was all true. I mean, it was all true. They were right. I mean, you know, television, like, you know, it's not, I would not want the impression about this piece to be like, you know, before Facebook came out, everyone was really great. And in this wonderful world of integration and authenticity, and then Facebook came along and destroyed it. Facebook comes along at the end of a very long process of alienation that's been described in a huge number of superb books. I mean, Bowling Alone came out in 2001, really before even we really knew how profound the internet was going to be. You know, I mean, I guess we knew, but we hadn't really seen how much it took over daily life.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it blamed television for a lot, and it was right. It's also true with the telephone, with the grocery store. I mean, when A&P came in and sort of eliminated your local grocery by providing, you know, reliable products, people stopped having a relationship to their grocer.
Hmm.
So, you know, what this is Facebook is at the end of a very long journey. The thing about Facebook is that it brings that kind of alienation that consumerist culture really inevitably has into your social life itself. Right? Brings it right into where all your friends are.
Let's spend a moment talking about the scale and the reach of Facebook, which you outline in your article. It is, as you say, hard to comprehend how many people are using this every single day. It's huge.
It's staggering. I mean, it is mind-blowing. I mean, they had 1 trillion page views a month.
Wow.
So, I mean, you know, like, there are some, I was unable to verify it, but there are some people who claim that that is as much as all media, like all old media combined.
Oh.
Right? I mean, I wasn't able to verify that, but it's close. It's not that far away. So, you know, it's a staggering feat. But, you know, more than that, I mean, the thing that I found incredible was the stat on the number of people 18 to 34 who check it before they get out of bed. It's like 28%. Mm-hmm. Are checking it on their cell phones before they get a cup of coffee in the morning. I mean, it's that kind of perpetual identity formation. It's the, you know, I mean, to me, my ultimate conclusion is it's the relentlessness of Facebook that's so new.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's a good way to describe it. It is relentless.
Yeah, I mean, you're constantly on it, and you're constantly navigating yourself and other people's selves, and that's not really healthy.
And when you get up in the morning, before you do anything, you're checking Facebook. Are you writing a message about what your day is going to be, or are you looking at what other people have written about themselves, or are you looking at what people may have said about what you wrote yesterday? What's first?
Well, you know, Facebook, the one thing that I think is really important to get out of this research, particularly out of Burke's research, is that Facebook is very far from a monolithic entity.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of different activities that happen on Facebook, and they all have different psychological profiles. They all have people use it for different things. It's much more complicated even than something like email, which is really just sort of one function. There's the wall, there's GChat, there's status updates, there's all this stuff. These all have different functionalities, and they all have different sort of sociological consequences that go along with them. I think, you know, the answer to that is it's idiosyncratic. You know, I mean, people use it for what, you know, it depends what they want out of it.
What do you use it for?
Well,
other
I'm
than old girlfriends?
I'm not a huge, I use Facebook to sort of keep up with some friends who are far, you know, who are in Saudi Arabia and stuff like that, who are a million miles away.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I'm not one of the people who are perpetually on Facebook. I'm perpetually on Twitter, which is, you know, more or less the same. It's just, you know, and I use it to get new stuff, and I use it to, you know, make little comments that I feel are witty, and, you know, the general, I certainly am not excusing myself from the general narcissistic rise here, you know. But, yeah, I use it for a bunch of different things.
Mm-hmm. So you're a witty Twitter guy.
Well, attempted? Is that... That's probably closer.
Well, you might indeed be very witty. I haven't followed you.
Awesome.
I'll have to do. I'm just new to that whole Twitter thing. I didn't get that till about a month ago. So,
oh, I love it.
Yeah,
I have to say. I mean, I love it.
Hmm. You, a lot of people in the audience, and we'll go to the audience in a moment. Our lines are all buzzing here. Saw the movie The Social Network. You write in your piece that the depiction of Mark Zuckerberg as a bastard with symptoms of Asperger's syndrome was nonsense. But it felt true. It felt true to Facebook. Why did it feel true?
Well, I think there's this general suspicion. There's always been this kind of suspicion hovering over Facebook that it produces enemy, that it produces this kind of disconnected but super connected reality. You know, I mean, I love the Google Plus thing when you sign up for Google Plus and it says you're real friends. I mean, it's just so much like what my mother would say, right? Like, you know, make sure it's your real friends that you're telling this stuff to.
Right.
But you know, the thing is, that's not what I wanted to do in this piece is, like, take that suspicion, which I had and which I shared, and then just apply it to, and then just actually see if it was true. Like, actually look at the gold standard research on the subject and try and figure out how it worked one way or the other.
We go to phone calls, and we'll do it in just a moment. We're talking with Stephen Marsh this hour of the program. He has a very interesting piece in the May issue of The Atlantic. You can find it online. Is Facebook making us lonely? 800-486-8655 is the number, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls, starting with Gay in Madison. Hi, Gay.
Yes, hi. I guess I couldn't disagree with the guest more. And I also come from a generation, you know, way before Facebook. I don't tweet or Twitter or whatever it's called, but it comes to the same thing. But my premise is this, and it's based on a little anecdote that just happened to me, and that is a former professor and good longtime friend of mine, actually a person I had an affair with at one point, long after I was a student, but criticized me heavily over dinner with my husband and his wife and said, you know, this is, you just post too much and you post about silliness. And I said, well, you know, you don't have to read it. And then we joked about it. And I said, you're so out of here. I'm going to block you so bad. And he said something like, you know, da, da, da. And I said, it's a social medium. It is not The Economist. You know, people go on there to say silly things and sometimes weighty things, as in our current political situation in our state. Lots of politicking and lots of getting together goes on Facebook. So it can be used for all kinds of things, as your guest knows. But I also just retired, and I am a little more lonely than I used to be, and so I reach out to my real friends and friends that have been. I know almost everybody that I talk to on Facebook in person and see them in person, but it makes it, it's like letter writing or anything else. It is a medium to that you can use to get in touch with people and express things that they will appreciate. So after this, I griped online about my professor, you know, having said this about me and hurt my feelings, and that I'm not asking for a lot of sympathy here, but I do want to say this is how I use Facebook, and I got 35 responses saying, don't stop now, you know, we like the poetry, we like the wit, da-da-da-da, this person is probably just a voyeur who, you know, enjoys sniping. So the short story is that I defriended him. He came back, apologized online in the discussion, and as of this morning, I unblocked him. I made him grovel a little bit.
Stephen, what do you think of that story?
Well, I mean, I think the key statement is there is that you see everyone on your Facebook page in real life. I mean, you know, John Cacioppo, who's the director of, you know, neuroscience at University of Chicago and is, you know, the world-leading expert on loneliness, he did his study says pretty clearly that, you know, the proportion of, if you have a higher proportion of real-life contacts compared to online interactions, your loneliness goes down, and the opposite is also true. That piece of research is really not negotiable. So if you're using Facebook to communicate with people that you see in real life, and you're using it to bring those, negotiate things with those relationships, as you have clearly done with this discussion of unfriending and so on, then it does, you know, it does lead to an increase in social capital. It's just that if you use Facebook, as many do, to passively receive information and skulk around and then post information, then it will make you more lonely. So, you know, the point of the article is not that, the point is, with loneliness, it really is how you use it. It's not whether you use it. And I would say it is a little different from letters, because there is no way that, letters are one form of communication. They're not multiple forms of communication, and also they're not really, you know, they don't open this world of passive reception of other people's selves. So I would say that the way you're using it, of course, is going to make you less lonely, but not everyone uses it the way you do.
And I think that all of us who use Facebook have been validated by it. She got validated that he did the wrong thing and she did the right thing. And we do that with pictures of our family. Oh, don't you have an interesting family? Or you've got this thought, and you like it when people respond to what you have to say. What about this process of validation? Does it make a difference if it's over a computer? Can you build yourself up on Facebook, and that's a good thing?
You know what? I never asked that question. I don't actually know the answer to it. I don't know. That's the short answer. I know that communication in general has a greater effect than non-communication. So, like, if you write someone a note saying, your kid is so cute, rather than just liking the one-click like that has a measurable effect on the decrease of loneliness and depression. But, And I would assume, although I don't actually know, that a face-to-face compliment matters more than that written communication. I think it's common sense, but the more effort someone puts into validating you, the better you feel.
Right. Yeah. Bob in River Falls. Hi, Bob.
Hi. How you doing?
All right.
Say, before I mention the Facebook thing, I just thought of something. A lot of us walk around in a haze and a fog because we're not in the now or the present. And I grew up around a lot of I had multi-generational contact. I had huge families, relatives. And I was around a lot of people when I was growing up, and a lot of people that grew up in the last early in the century, and I had teachers that went to college in the early, like in the 1930s. So I was heard a lot of the oral culture. And what I do a lot of times, I got random encounters with store clerks. If they're kids or something or younger people, you can hit them with something unexpected, an observation or a comment or some silly remark, and then turn it into a little conversation. And they actually snaps them out of the fog, gets their attention. All of a sudden, they really enjoy the contact, and they enjoy having someone talk to them and listen to them, actually pay attention to them. And a lot of people just need that. Number two, Facebook itself, to me, is so overwhelming, and you're being bombarded with so much garbage that I actually feel kind of constricted. I feel like I'm claustrophobic when I'm looking at it. I can't stand it. I can only tolerate it for a couple of minutes, and I got to get off. Because it's just, there's too much. And I do like it for the political uses. But the personal stuff, the narcissistic stuff, it's nauseating. And one of the things I saw was somebody posted a picture of their new $60,000 SUV with
Whoa.
Them standing next to it. And I thought, why would you put a picture of you with your car? Who cares? I mean, that's preposterous. The last thing I'm going to mention, a friend of mine that I grew up with that lives thousands of miles away, is very ill, and he sent me a note, and he lives with his cat, and he doesn't have any family or anything, and he sent me a message, and he said, I miss the human touch, just feeling something. And that made me really feel sad, and I think that's what we're dealing with here, is that kind of thing, and I'll listen.
Yeah, thanks, Bob. Steven?
Well, I mean, the rise in loneliness is just shocking. I mean, the living alone has risen enormously, from 10% to, I think it's 27% now. But there is a lot of research that says that living alone doesn't necessarily lead to an increase in loneliness. Or it's not things that you think make you less lonely don't always have that effect. Like, believing in God doesn't necessarily mean you'll be less lonely. Being married doesn't necessarily mean you'll be less lonely. But there is this huge spike in loneliness that we really have to start addressing, because to me it's the dominant social issue. I mean, I'll be frank, that's what I believe. I think that it has all sorts of political questions associated with it. I think it goes to the questions of inequality and other economic issues. There's no doubt. There is really very little doubt that loneliness is on a huge spike right now.
But isn't there, at the risk of getting too existential here, isn't this part of just sort of the human condition as well? That, when you get really sick, you do it alone. When you die, you do it alone. When you're born, you do it alone. That we all have these moments that in which we realize that we are pretty lonely, because that's our plight in a way.
I really beg to differ.
All
right. I think the one thing that you, and when you read John Cacioppo's book on loneliness, the most amazing thing is how much of our brain is devoted to socialization. It's virtually, it's all different parts of it. I mean, the way that you can read people's, the ability to read people's faces requires a huge amount of brain space. We are social animals before we're anything. Our brains are designed to gossip far more than they're designed to do math. And I think the one thing you have to understand is that this idea that we have that you're born and you die alone, first of all, that's not really that true. I mean, when you're born into a room full of people. And when you die, you're usually God willing, you're with a lot of people. I think we are very much social animals, and that's why when we are, this new rise in loneliness has all of these immense health consequences. I mean, that was the one thing that really shocked me in this writing this piece. I mean, you're I think it's 50% more likely to die of a heart condition if you're lonely. After surgery, you recover from surgery, your inflammation rate is much higher if you're lonely. It is not this idea that we're necessarily alone is actually really not true. We're born to be social. That's our biological reality. And when as always, when you fight against biology, you're going to lose.
Let's go to Mike in Whitefish Bay. Hi, Mike.
Good morning. I'm an old guy,
And I was at the University of Chicago in the 50s, and I had a very celebrated sociology professor named Riesman, and he wrote a book that was very prominent at the time called The Lonely Crowd, which deals with a lot of the issues that your guest is alluding to. In addition, to lighten the mood, I saw a cartoon in the Milwaukee paper a while back, and it shows a funeral parlor. And there's about several hundred chairs spread around for the attendees, but there's only one person there, and the funeral director is looking at his associate and saying, I don't understand this. He had 250 Facebook friends.
Oh, that'd be good to put in your article,
yeah.
Stephen.
Well, the Riesman's, I mean, he's obviously the Fonz. I mean, he is the Fonz at Orojo, the beginning of the whole of the sociology of loneliness. Which, you know, there have been many great studies about the pursuit of loneliness, and then Putnam's book, Bowling Alone, which was just 2001. These are all great studies. His was really the beginning. I recently reread that book for this piece, and I have to say it's fascinating because, you know, he's speaking about lonely people who feel trapped in conformist society, 1950s conformist society, so in the army or in unions or in churches. Like, you know, and it's sort of like when you're reading it, you're like, when you read the stuff that comes after, it's like, well, all of those things fell apart. All of these memberships fell apart. How could these guys be lonely when they had a union? Now we don't have any union. We don't have the unions. We don't have the Elks. We don't have the Masons. We don't have that stuff. It's just a fascinating read when you've read the other stuff beforehand. It's an amazing book.
It's been some time talking about what's wired in the American character. You talk about this, that we flee the cramped city to a house in the suburbs or a McMansion, and it way out beyond that, we spend more time in our cars. It's at the American core, this kind of loneliness, and it's part of our appetite for independence.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the one thing that is reliably true across every aspect of American culture. I mean, just to you know, Song of Myself by Walt Whitman, I mentioned Self-Reliance by Emerson, Moby Dick, which is a story of the sort of ultimate loneliness of this whaling captain. But then also, like, Jackson Pollock was about individuals' expression, and so is Jay-Z. You know, I mean, so hip-hop is also about self-promotion, self-identification. You know, every aspect of American, you know, American religious culture is about a personal relationship to Jesus. It's not, not all of it, but certainly a major part of it is. This relationship to the self is really, really at the core of American life. And that's why I think you can see it spread for, you know, 200 years.
Let's go to this email. Sarah writes this, I think that after Facebooking and texting and Twittering all day, my children have had all their conversations and they're not used to talking. I'm left feeling inept and antiquated, and I think of myself as an interesting person. This is the loneliness that you're speaking of.
Well, I mean, there was an Australian study called Who Uses Facebook that said that Facebook led to decreases in social loneliness, but dramatic increases in family loneliness.
Yes,
which may be what the emailer is talking about. I would say kids not talking to their parents, ancient as time. You know, I mean, that we cannot blame Facebook and Twitter for that. I mean, that has been true for 2,000-3,000 years. So, but you know, there is some evidence that there is an increase in family loneliness with the use of Facebook.
Gary in Ripon. Hi, Gary.
Hi. I was just going to comment that sometimes people are lonely in a room full of people. My mother-in-law is in her 70s, and her family will be there with grandchildren and her family of children there in the living room, and some of them are even there from out of state, and she'll be on Facebook for sometimes up to an hour, letting her friends know that her family is there visiting, while her family is basically asking her to hop off the computer and talk to them. And then later, they get to see the post thanking them for the wonderful visit they had.
Oh, my goodness.
Facebook.
Why is she doing it, do you think?
She's just addicted to the technology. And I guess likewise, on kind of a sub-note on that topic, one of the other things that I think is starting to make me a little lonely is nobody wants to use the phone anymore. Everybody wants a text, and
I don't
text. So essentially, I've got friends who I am afraid to call because they feel bothered by anything beyond a text.
Right. Well, I mean, you can't, you have to get on text. I think modernity is just not allowing you to do that, especially since the death of voicemail. Like, nobody, to me, like, leaving a voicemail message is like leaving a message scrawled in chalk on a sidewalk. I mean, it's not, nobody will pay attention to it. But the, Sherry Turkle's book has a lot of stories. Like the story of the grandmother mediating the experience. I mean, the beauty of it is, like, the reason I would say, not to psychoanalyze, but you know, you get to mediate the experience. You get control. You have control on Facebook. So when your grandchildren say something that embarrasses you, you can just sort of not post it. You know, you can get away from the messiness of social life, which is so kind of gross. Right, and you can escape that by having a program that you can control what you see and what other people see.
I didn't know people don't do voicemail anymore. I feel really antiquated here.
voicemails. I mean, I hate it. That one to me is good riddance to bad garbage. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess it's different city to city, but. Leaving a voicemail message where I am is like, forget it. No one will.
Really? I just didn't know that. Huh. Well, thanks very much for the call, Gary. Peter in Stoughton, hi.
Good morning. I'll be another one to disagree with your guest. I find that Facebook creates the opposite of loneliness for me. I have a little over 100 friends. A third of these are people that I'll never meet, and I never have. A third of them are probably people that I haven't seen in 10 or 20 years, except for maybe high school reunion. And a third of them are people that, you know, they might live nearby, but I just don't have much occasion to see them. But at the same time, yesterday I spent quite a bit of time on Facebook because a Facebook friend from high school brought into intensive care for some health issues that he had. So I was putting the word out to other friends that we shared that this guy was in trouble. Once again, all these other friends that we share, a lot of them will have never met him, but they've read his blog and enjoyed it quite a bit. Day before that, I acquired a Facebook friend in Tierra del Fuego. I'm not making this up. Well, why and how did you do this? Well, I noticed that this person who had commented on another person's Facebook posting attended Stoughton High School, which is where I live and which is where my daughter attends high school. So I now have a friend with a view from the opposite side of the world, and we have some things in common, but this person, she's a woman probably 10, 15 years older than I suddenly have a window on another part of the world that simply wouldn't be available to me.
Steven.
Oh, well, I mean, I think, you know, one of the things I'm trying to get at in this piece is that it's very much not like Facebook bad, Facebook good. I mean, there are lots of different ways of using it. And obviously, if you're using it to make, you know, I mean, look at Egypt. Look at the political in the Middle East, like the way that Twitter and Facebook were used there. I mean, this is not, and there are lots of examples like that. I mean, a friend of mine just got cancer, and we had to raise a lot of money for him because he's a writer. And we use Facebook and we use the internet, and it was amazing. And, you know, if you look at a program like Kickstarter, like, how wonderful that people are raising money for artistic projects through these social media. I'm just really dealing with the large-scale social consequences of this activity, not its particular use in these individual instances, which are, of course, particular. You know, don't really, you know, and I'm sure there are millions of examples of them. But, you know, as I said in the piece, it really depends how you use Facebook.
And I hope that all the people who heard about your friend's health issues, that somehow your friend benefited from that, who has the health issues.
Oh, sure. I mean, artist, yeah, old artist.
We're all hanging on, but you talked about the narcissism. I must be completely guilty of narcissism because I'm complimented by all of the talented and wonderful people that include me as their friends.
Oh.
This is everything from guitarist for a band that you've heard of to a colonel in the United States Army. You know, there are all these people who value me that much, and I can value them and what they contribute to my life.
Well, that's a good thing, Stephen. He feels more valued, right?
Well, yes, I suppose it is good that he feels more valued. All I can say is that narcissism correlates very strongly with Facebook usage, and that what that means is that when you're thinking about yourself all the time, you know, I mean, one of the more profound studies that I looked at in this thing is from a researcher named Iris. You know, obviously, also, I can't really speak to the individual psychology of a person that I am talking to on the phone across a continent. But, you know, one of the more interesting studies that came up in this research was by a woman named Iris Mouse in Denver, where she studied, I think this is one of the most fascinating studies I've seen in a long time, how wanting happiness, trying to be happy, valuing happiness as an end, actually leads to less happiness. So, you know, in everything else in life, like if you value good grades, you're more likely to get good grades. But if you value happiness, you're less likely to be happy. This is a real tough problem because it goes away from like whatever validation we're getting. What is the end of that? I guess
the more you try to be happy, the less happy you are. Sophocles, you write, made roughly the same point.
Yes, I mean, I think one of the things about technology is that we tend to feel that it can be controlled, that we can use it to our desired effects, that we are making ourselves better and making ourselves that we are, you know, capable of manipulating our own lives through it. And I think that that's a very optimistic view of how technology affects us. And I think it's only partially true.
We welcome more phone calls, and here's how you reach us. Well, let me first tell you what you're listening to, in case you're just tuning us in. The author of a piece in the May issue of The Atlantic is Facebook Making Us Lonely. Stephen Marsh is our guest, and here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Lines are open for you right now. You can also send us I just think it would be appropriate to go to Facebook today because that's what we're talking about. And we're trying to make Facebook make you feel more valued on Facebook. So you can go to the Kathleen Dunn Show or you can send an email, which is talk@WPR.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this hour, it's been some time since we've talked about Shakespeare. And tomorrow we will, the Milwaukee Rep is doing Othello on motorcycles. And we are going to talk with the director of Othello and with the actor who's playing Othello tomorrow. So that's tomorrow. Back to phone calls. Tim in Burlington. Hi.
Yes, good morning.
Hi.
I have a couple comments. One, my main comment that I'd like to do for the last few years since we got texting and all this stuff going, I feel that we have never been so connected in our history, but so out of touch with each other. I think that's part of what's leading to all the loneliness, too, that your guest is talking about. Because these interactions are so frequent, and they're so superficial that nothing really comes through. And the gentleman that just called before us, I mean, he said that, you know, he spent all day on Facebook telling friends about, you know, his friend that was in the hospital. How about if you shut the computer off and you go see that guy in the hospital and actually do some interaction with him instead of spending your life electronically telling people that something is going on in the world? I mean, it just seems so sad.
Well, maybe they all did that. We don't know the end of the story. Maybe that's what happened as a result of it. You mentioned this in terms of not having confidence in our lives, that we may have all of these Facebook friends, but somebody who really knows who you are, a really, really good friend, that we're losing some of that, Stephen.
Oh, the decline in confidence is pretty shocking. I mean, it goes from basically everyone having three people to talk to having two people to talk. That'd be average. That goes from 1985 to 2004. But when things get really problematic is when you don't have any confidence. It just puts a huge amount of pressure on your social network.
Mm-hmm.
When you only have one or two people that you can talk to about the things that matter to you and feel like you're being understood. I think that is definitely a profound change in the way we're living. And as I said, I think it's a really inhuman one.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Tim, very much for your call. Katie in Spring Green, hi.
Hi, I just wanted to make the comment that I'm not sure where Mr. Marsh lives, but if he lived in the hills that I live in and the cell phone that I own doesn't work very much, I have texting turned off on my phone and I leave messages all the time because that's the only way we communicate out here rurally, is to try to catch somebody on the run. We can't have instant texting or instant Twitter because we don't have that kind of connection out here. So, I mean, he's maybe in a city where that's instant, but if you're rural, you don't have those connections anymore. Anyway, I'm going to hang up and I got to keep going. Thanks.
All right, bye, Katie.
Oh, too bad. I was curious. I'm curious about how that affects how the instantaneousness gets when that gets removed from the process, how that affects the technology. But I guess I'll have to find out some other way.
Yeah, that would be an interesting article for people who live like that.
Yeah, I sort of find that it's I guess the cliche is that instant communication is everywhere. I mean, I remember my mother was recently in India, in Sikkim, which is like the third poorest part of India, so very, very, very poor indeed.
Mm-hmm.
And perfect cell phone coverage.
Oh, my goodness. Isn't that something?
Right. Everywhere. Like, no, calling her, no problem.
Huh. And I'll bet it was a crystal clear communication. Mom, you sound like you're next door.
Right, yeah.
Katie's point made me wonder, though, has anybody done a really thorough study of happiness, looking at people who really are off the grid compared with people who are very much on the grid? Is there a correlation between being off the grid and possibly being happier?
Boy, I don't know. I didn't look into it. There must be.
I would think so.
I'm sure there would be. But I guess it would be really hard to define off the grid, though, right?
Right.
And because, like, being only having intermittent cell phone access when you're driving through the hills of Wisconsin is one thing, but that's sort of different from actually being completely off the grid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like living in, I do have friends who have done that, who have gone, get your own water in the back hills of Virginia and so on. But I don't know. I think it would be hard to find, test cases.
Hmm. Well, were they happy?
Yeah.
Also, they were.
How are you going to find people who are off the grid?
Right. Right. Were your friends, were they happy, carrying their own water?
They were happy until they had to deliver a baby by themselves.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then they discovered that civilization has its benefits as well as its costs.
Right. John in Watertown, hi.
Yeah, happiness is a state of mind, and it's also in your own heart where you're going to find that happiness, that balance, and that focus. Now, I'm single. I live alone. I'm never lonely a minute in my life. I have so much to do, so many places to go to and speak, so many places to write about. I drive a car that's $145,000, gets about 6 miles to a gallon. I want to get away from people. I don't want to communicate anymore.
Why don't you like people, John?
Sometimes I don't. No, I'm very perplexed by the terrible things they do and the decisions that they make and all the problems and the troubles they have as they go through life, and I don't have one of those.
Stephen.
What's the car?
What's it?
What's the car?
The car, a Bentley.
Oh, a Bentley. Nice. Well, then, you'll be fine.
You'll be fine. Oh, my. Most people, I would think, though, would say that human interaction plays a much bigger role in their overall happiness, that they need it, they crave it.
You know, there is a very interesting point, which is that loneliness and being alone don't necessarily correlate at all. Like, it's very possible to be alone and have solitude and feel and not feel lonely, whereas it's possible to be in a crowd and feel very lonely. So it's not just that, you know, it's not really the number of interactions, it's the quality of interactions that you have.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, then there are people like the recent guest who are, you know, perfectly content by themselves.
Right.
You know, and I don't think, you know, it's not this, there's not this huge range of, there is a huge, we're human beings, you know, there's a huge range of responses to everything. But I would say that the biology of loneliness is pretty startling. I mean, we really are social animals. We are built to be that way.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, generally speaking, when you deny that biology, it is disastrous for the animal.
Here's another Facebook message. I don't know how to pronounce the sender. I agree with people like Will Self with regard to what Facebook is becoming, a vehicle for suspending belief and project one's alter ego. That does not describe every Facebook user, just those that may lack interpersonal skills. Is that a fair critique, that it is the interpersonal skills of the user?
Yeah. I mean, that's Burke's big point, that that interpersonal skills offline have this huge effect on how you react to Facebook and how you deal with Facebook and what you get out of Facebook. I mean, that's part of the magazine article, but I mean, also part of it is that there are these things can have, like, if you're a lonely person and you go to Facebook, it will make you lonelier the longer you spend on it. Right, and then there's the larger trend, which is that Facebook is a narcissistic activity.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing we should spend at least a little while talking about is the effects of loneliness. Loneliness can be really damaging to our health.
Hugely, I mean, that's how, you know, this began. This piece began when I asked my mother again, who keeps coming up, who is a physician, like, what has changed over the course of your practice when she was retiring. And she said, you know, loneliness. And then I went through all this medical literature, which I didn't even bring up in the piece, where, you know, there are dozens and dozens of nursing journal articles about how to deal with the epidemic of loneliness. Psychotherapists, it's a huge question. People who are coming to psychotherapy, not because they have you know, they don't have actual problems. They have loneliness. They want somebody to talk to.
Mm-hmm.
And physicians having to deal with the same thing, which is very hard for them because, you know, they're used to having problems that they can treat. Go and do X. Take X. When it's loneliness, there's not really even, you know, there's not really a solution. You know, this is where it came out of. And there's no question that the medical profession feels that there is an epidemic of loneliness.
Mm-hmm.
Sweeping the Western world, not just America, you know, the whole of the Canada and Australia and Europe and et cetera.
Mm-hmm. I think it's one of the reasons we like talk shows, quite frankly. I think
yeah.
that it makes us less lonely.
Yeah, absolutely.
Don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, I would think. I mean, I would say that, yeah, definitely.
Thank you, John, for the call. Rose in Waupaca, hi.
Hi, I've been listening to this. It's a wonderful program. I actually am plagued by this whole thing. I have three kids, and they're all kind of like in their like 20s, early 20s. And when they all get together, come and visit me, grandma, whatever, I feel, and I'm alone. My husband passed away 2 years ago. He was a veteran. And when they leave, I feel actually less lonely when they're gone because they're talking about stuff. And, oh, shut up, Mom. You don't know what you're doing.
Hmm.
And then when I go and I volunteer over at the veterans home where I'm one-on-one with these individuals who can't, you know, really do anything, I have a wonderful time because we're talking about their, you know, these events that happened and these wonderful people in their lives. But when my kids come up, which is supposed to be a fabulous time, nobody's talking. You know, and it baffles me, and it is a concern, actually.
Mm. We have about a minute left, Stephen.
Well, I mean, I think human relationships, family dynamics are always complicated and always are always fraught, you know. But I would say that one thing that is kind of interesting is that the connections that you make with people face to face, even outside of your family network or really close networks, can be very profound and can have an incredibly meaningful and positive impact in your life. I'll just end with this. One of Cacioppo's most interesting parts in this book is he says that people who are less lonely have higher incomes. That's a strong correlation.
Oh, really?
But it's not because people who have money are more connected. It's actually the opposite. If you're more connected, you make more money. So it's sort of a proof for karma. Like, the more you give, the more you get from your relationship. Mm. That's clear.
Hmm. Well, what a great hour. And thank you so much for being with us, Stephen.
It was a pleasure.
Our pleasure as well. Stephen Marsh, can we put this on Facebook? Can we put the article? We'll do the article on Facebook. Is Facebook making us lonely? It will be on our Facebook page, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Thanks to Brett Jaspers for producing this interesting article. He's our new producer. Say hi to him and make him feel less lonely. I don't know if he's lonely, but welcome him to Wisconsin. And thanks to Brett as well for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. Great conversations ahead.